Most of us, when it comes to filling a prescription, have little idea of the path a pill takes from the drug manufacturer to your pharmacist. When it comes to pain medications or controlled substances, those pills take an even more meandering path. Our guests today explain that route and the reasoning behind the path of pain medications in this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org, practicalbioethics.org. Joining us on the program are Bob Twillman, Director of Policy and Advocacy for the American Academy of Pain Management, and Myra Christopher, the holder of the Kathleen Foley Chair for Pain and Palliative Care at the Center for Practical Bioethics. Bob, lots of people and organizations are involved in this path, in the delivery of pain medications. Describe for us, if you would, what that path looks like.
Well, that path starts with a manufacturer having a product that they want to manufacture and then sell to people. Before they can do that, they have to do a number of clinical trials to prove that it really works, that it's safe and effective, and prove that to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA then can approve that medication, or they can send it back for more study, or they can reject it. Once it's approved, and then if it's a controlled substance, they have to decide which schedule of the controlled substances schedules to put it into. There are five schedules for those medications.
And from one to five, one is a minimal kind of drug, and five is the maximum?
No, actually, Schedule 1 drugs are those that are drugs of abuse that are thought not to have any medical utility. So that includes heroin, it includes cocaine, it includes methamphetamines, and it includes marijuana. Schedule 2 are opioid pain medications for the most part, those that exist as a single agent, so there's nothing mixed with them. So that would be morphine, fentanyl, oxycodone, those types of things. Schedule 3 is predominantly combination products. It's a combination of an opioid like hydrocodone with acetaminophen or aspirin. Schedule 4 has typically benzodiazepines in it. Those are anxiety drugs, drugs like Valium and Xanax and so forth. And then Schedule 5 has medications that have minimal likelihood of being abused, but still some potential for that.
Is there some jockeying that's done somewhat for a particular drug to be placed in a particular schedule?
Yeah, the manufacturers do try to work that because the lower the number of your schedule. So Schedule 2, for instance, is more restrictive than Schedule 3. So Schedule 2 medications can't be refilled. You have to have a written prescription for every time you want to fill a prescription of that medication. Schedule 3 medications, on the other hand, can be called into your pharmacy. You can have refills on them and so forth. So to try to get them into a less controlled schedule is the goal of the manufacturers.
So there are no over-the-counter medications that are in that schedule?
That's correct. All scheduled medications, all controlled substances are by prescription only.
So you go through that process, and then what happens from there? How do things end up in the pharmacy?
Well, so then the manufacturer has to say, okay, I've got this controlled substance. I'm approved to manufacture it. I need to talk to the Drug Enforcement Administration and get a quota from them as to how much I will be allowed to manufacture in a given year. So the DEA every year for every one of the controlled substances sets a quota as to how much of that medication can be manufactured. Occasionally, you get partway through the year and the manufacturer realizes it's not going to be enough and they will go back for a supplemental addition to the quota and so forth. But the DEA maintains the control of how much of that medication can be manufactured. So once it's manufactured, then the manufacturer sells the drug to a drug wholesaler. The wholesaler then will sell that to a retail pharmacy, and that's how it gets to your pharmacy. Now, of course, at each step in that process, there's paperwork that has to be done, and all of that paperwork reports back to the Drug Enforcement Administration so that they can track the entire path of a pill from the manufacturer all the way through to the pharmacy when it's dispensed to the patient.
And Bob mentioned the role of the DEA with regard to licensure for physicians who prescribe, or not just physicians, but clinicians.
Right.
Who prescribe.
The DEA also has a registration that they give to prescribers who prescribe controlled substances, as well as to pharmacists who dispense controlled substances. So in addition to regulating the manufacturers, they're also regulating the people who administer these medications, who prescribe them and dispense them to the patients. And what they're looking at with that is basically, is this a safe provider who's going to do this appropriately? It's how they essentially how they make that decision.
Now, I've worked with doctors in the past that they've mentioned DEA numbers, and that's how they track how those prescriptions are done, correct?
That's right. So each of the prescribers, each of the pharmacists will have a specific DEA number that's specific to them. And actually, if they practice in two locations, technically, or if, for instance, if they were to practice in two states, like here in Kansas City, they practice in both Missouri and Kansas, they'd have to have a different DEA number for each state. So by having those numbers, all those numbers have to be included on every prescription for a controlled substance, and so then the DEA is able to track not only where the pills are going in terms of the distribution chain, but they can track then what the physician is prescribing.
Well, now, Myra, Bob is describing what sounds like a logical path, but it seems like there's some bumps along the road. That happens, doesn't it?
Well, I think Bob and I would both agree that the system itself is really fairly well thought out. I mean, this has been in place for decades now and, in general, works well. But like any system, it is vulnerable to outside pressures and forces. And what we are seeing now is that as we are trying to deal with two conflicting sometimes or two public health issues that are in tension with one another, one being the undertreatment of chronic pain, about which Bob and I care a great deal, and another being the abuse of prescription pain medications for illicit purposes. So now we see, and Bob, comment if you disagree with me, but we see this system that's really put in place for the purpose of making sure that safe and effective drugs get to people who are in need of them, being put under a bright light or scrutiny because of behaviors that have nothing to do with them. I mean, it's a different matter. And so the system is being challenged, and there are people who want to change it. They want to reschedule drugs. They want to prescription monitoring programs. I mean, there are lots of efforts to try to figure out how to balance, we use that word, I think, pretty loosely, these two public health issues. And chronic pain patients get caught in the middle of that.
Well, go ahead, Bob.
The DEA is actually in an interesting position because by the law that established the DEA, they have two mandates. Mm-hmm. One of their mandates is to make these medications available to people who need them for legitimate medical purposes. The second mandate they have is to prevent these medications from being misused and abused. And as long as, you know, they can find that sort of balance and be able to do that in a reasonable way, then there's no problem. But when you start finding solutions to the abuse problem that impact the availability of the medications, that's where you get into trouble.
Well, the prescription monitoring program, I hear and see in the news that there are a number of different states that are considering that type of approach if they haven't implemented it already. But what I heard you describe earlier was something that to me sounded like a great deal of bureaucracy, bureaucratic demands that are placed on a medical practice in the first place to be able to prescribe these in the first place.
Right. Well, they are, after all, called controlled substances, and that's the control part of the name there. They put these controls in place in order to try to maintain some handle on where these medications are going.
I wonder, Myra, with that, if for some medical practices or clinicians, that's somewhat of the last straw, with the added bureaucratic demands that they decide, you know, it's no longer worth it for me to be able to prescribe these medications, even though I might want to.
Well, we've been hearing that complaint for a long, long time now. You know, physicians, I think, and other clinicians, I think, value their autonomy. I think they're people who generally are committed to the healing professions because of a calling, literally. And I think that often they resent having people look over their shoulders, question their motivation, question their integrity. And I think everybody knows that we live in a complex society, and, you know, there's some of that that is absolutely necessary. But I think that, and we've seen this a number of times, that there are instances. I'm thinking about the triplicate prescription laws some years ago where doctors were asked by states to buy prescription pads that had three copies that were serially numbered. And if they didn't have that prescription pad, they couldn't write a medication for their patient. The idea was that they were obligated to put one in the patient's chart, give one to the patient to take to the pharmacist, and send one to the state. Well, in California would be a great example, who I think was one of the first states to pass the TRIP script laws, as we call them. Nearly 30% of the doctors in that state who had a license, who had a valid DEA license, just threw up their hands and said, enough. You know, I am not doing this. That's not what I was called into medicine to do. So clearly these bureaucratic approaches, and that's not a pejorative word. I mean, it is a bureaucracy. It is a system in place. Do impact the practice of clinicians and the care that people receive.
I think one of the other issues that clinicians have with this whole arena is that, in essence, they're being told what they can and cannot do with their patients by essentially police officers who have no medical training whatsoever. And I think they really resent that fact as well.
Still, it comes down to what we have talked about in the past around the issue of professionalism. And we've had people like Dr. Richard Payne coming to Kansas City and speak about that nationally, a very well-known physician. And so he is somewhat contrary with some of his peers whenever it comes to that. But professionalism is a big deal, right?
It is a big deal. And, you know, we're really seeing it play out in the current situation that we have with these pain medications in particular, because there are some places in you know, the place I think of the most is Florida, where they're having all sorts of issues in Florida. And it appears as though what's happened is that the strategy for controlling the drug problem in Florida has become one of minimizing the supply of the medications. Well, that's okay if those medications are only used by people who abuse them. But the fact is, these medications are used much more often by people who use them for legitimate medical purposes, and now they're having trouble getting access to their medications. And what that does is it puts, in particular in Florida, it puts the pharmacists in a bad place, because pharmacists are told by the DEA, by virtue of having a DEA registration number, you have two duties. You have the duty to treat your patient as a healthcare professional to provide for their health, but you also have a duty to make sure that these medications are not being used inappropriately. And so they're, in essence, telling pharmacists, and they tell doctors this too, you not only have to be a healthcare professional, but to some extent you also have to be a cop. And there's a lot of sentiment in the medical community that we really have to be able to keep doctors doctors and cops cops. And that when the two try to do each other's jobs, that's when we get into trouble. So how that plays out in professionalism is a pharmacist has a duty to determine when a prescription is presented whether it's legal and legitimate. And if they decide on the basis of whatever criteria they use to make those decisions that it's not legal or it's not legitimate, their duty is to not fill that prescription. And what we're seeing in a lot of cases in Florida is that there's a lot of this going on where people are not filling prescriptions, and it's not clear to what extent that's based on any kind of rational criteria for deciding whether or not they're legal and legitimate. And it's also clear that most of the time when that happens, when that prescription is refused, there's no attempt by the healthcare providers to help the patient find another place that will fill that prescription. So that's where the professionalism begins to break down, because it's as though there's no sense that it's the obligation, the moral obligation of that pharmacist, or in some cases the prescribers, to help that patient find what they need.
Well, and I think there's another tension that plays into this too, because most of these outlets or retail chains, patients don't go to the hospital to get their medications. They go to the local corner drugstore. And the pharmacist, who is an employee now of the organization, of the corporation, has also competing duties and obligations as a person hired by that company to keep them safe, to help them make a profit. So really it is that we're setting the pharmacist up to play multiple roles. And when we, you know, around here we kind of take this simplistic notion about what it means to do ethics. But when you're thinking about doing it, one of the first things you have to ask is, what is my role here? Why am I in this? What is my relationship to this person? What rights do they have? And what responsibilities do I have to them? And, you know, we do this sort of simple-minded thing about saying, okay, who are the stakeholders here? You know, to whom do you have loyalties and obligations? Well, healthcare professionals generally, because it's kind of a conditioned response, will say, oh, the patient. You know, my first duty is to the patient. But if you push a little bit about that, I mean, let's just use the pharmacist just as an example, not that we're going to pick on them. But they also have obligations then to the DEA, to law enforcement. And it's not just the DEA, because the local constable or prosecutor may be breathing down their back as well. They also have obligations to their employer. So we have really boxed them into this situation. And I think generally, I think that Lawrence Kohlberg's work, you're a psychologist, would jump in here with me, that when people are put in stressful situations where their well-being, their livelihood, their status is called into question, people resort to a lower moral order. Professionalism seems to slip. And, you know, I've heard, and I know you have too, Bob, heard people say, you know, I get it. I know as a doc, I know as a nurse, I know as a pharmacist, but I'm not going to get fired over this guy. You know, this guy's got tattoos all over him. Well, you know, so I think it is a very challenging place. And Bob and I have recently had the opportunity to be in some conversation with people who are actually doing education about for pharmacists, and who are really struggling with this. You know, how do we prepare our professionals in training to confront this pretty toxic, hostile world? And we're also hearing these terrible stories of where people with chronic pain are going in, being treated as though they are drug users, where they are being, frankly, people are profiteering because they're saying, we don't have enough of this drug. So, you know, by golly, we're a capitalistic society, and we love that old supply and demand thing. So put your insurance card back in your pocket and give me a whole bunch of cash. And if you can't pay it today, then you're not going to get it. So, again, this is kind of to what Bob was saying originally. When you build a system, and it's a very logical, well-thought-out, rational system, but then these external forces come into play to stress that system, sometimes it falls apart. And often there are vulnerable people who become victims of other things that they have no control over.
So, Bob, as a final question then, it sounds like we have a lot of work to do.
Well, yes, we do have a lot of work to do. You know, I really feel bad for the pharmacists in these cases who get caught in this, because their employer is telling them, you must fill X number of scripts per hour in order for us to be profitable. The profession of pharmacy is telling them, you know, we have to spend more time with our patients. We have to do more counseling with our patients so they understand these medications, how to use them safely. The FDA is telling them the same thing. The DEA and other police forces, law enforcement entities are telling them, you've got to be really careful that you don't contribute to this problem. You know, the pressure on them is tremendous.
Well, I think there's another factor here, too, and I think it would be wrong not to point out that chronic pain patients are beginning to feel pretty kicked around and very suspect. You know, when we think about the professional patient or provider consumer relationship, however you want to characterize that, it's been one based on trust and confidence that the healthcare professional is there to do what's in our best interest. But when we see these external pressures causing people to behave in ways that makes that questionable, if not doubtful, then that relationship breaks down. And then you have consumers who can be pretty confrontational, pretty hostile, pretty angry. And so it just, it's like pouring gasoline on a burning fire. I mean, it is just a very bad situation, and we've got to address this.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it today. Bob Twillman is Director of Policy and Advocacy for the American Academy of Pain Management. Meyer Christopher is the holder of the Kathleen Foley Chair for Pain and Palliative Care at the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.